This is early. We're having an unusual weather pattern, which is exactly like we normally get in the dead of winter.
Cold, clear weather causes air quality problems for the Fairbanks area. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 25th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a crew from The Deadliest Catch may face legal action for a bad decision involving a stowaway.
Of course, not all the islands in the Aleutians have rats, and so we certainly don't want to get rats on any new islands.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Attorneys gave their opening arguments today in the trial of a Huna man accused of killing two police officers in 2010. John Marvin Jr. faces murder and weapons charges in the deaths of Sergeant Anthony Wallace and Officer Matthew Tokuoka of the Huna Police Department. The two were gunned down in front of Marvin's home in August 2010. KTOO reporter Matt Miller has been covering the trial and joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Lori.
Matt, describe the case that District Attorney David Brower laid out against John Marvin Jr.
Well, essentially what had happened, according to Brower, is that in August of 2010, two police officers, Tokuoka and Wallace, were gathering. They had basically a social gathering on Huna Street, and basically without any significant provocation, they were shot at from a home across the street. And both of them were killed, and Dave Brower believes that the resident of the house, John Marvin Jr., was the one responsible for killing them. Both Wallace and Tokuoka died as a result of their injuries. And as a result of the incident, state troopers, Juneau police, other officers from around Southeast ended up traveling to Huna to respond to the situation, and that it was roughly about a day before Marvin apparently surrendered.
What did defense attorney Eric Hedlund say in opening arguments to defend his client?
Essentially, his response was that a lot of the evidence that the prosecution was going to put on was going to be circumstantial, that the evidence would require that the jurors would have to infer that Marvin was, in fact, the shooter. Nobody actually saw him with the weapon or shoot at the two officers. So it was really, in Hedlund's view, it's really difficult for responsibility that you put on Marvin for shooting and killing the two officers.
Has John Marvin made any sort of a confession or a statement to police in the time leading up to trial?
Not that I am aware of. It's not something that I've been able to determine yet as of yet. But he has apparently did talk with, he has talked with officers, and he's of course tried to communicate with his attorney, but as far as any particular type of confession, that is not something that is being that has been brought up yet so far in court proceedings.
How long is the trial expected to last?
The trial is expected to last at least for the next week and a half, possibly into the end of next week. And Superior Court Judge David George is currently considering a possible Saturday session to hear witnesses and present evidence, which would be kind of rare for here in Junior Superior Court. But at this point, it's expected to last a total of 2 weeks into the end of next week.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt Miller is a reporter at KTOO covering the trial of John Marvin Jr., accused of killing two police officers in Huna in 2010. Fairbanks' North Pole area air quality is degraded due to winter-like weather and emissions from heating and vehicles. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the fine particulate pollution is happening unusually early.
It's normally a little later in the fall when cold air inversions trap smoke at ground level in the Fairbanks area. Fairbanks North Star Borough air quality technician Jim McCormick says the situation's unusual for October.
This is early. We're having an unusual weather pattern, which is exactly like we normally get in the dead of winter.
McCormick says the cold, still air is resulting in poor dispersion of emissions.
We're experiencing a wintertime inversion where it's gotten cold, the inversion is low, and normal heating, burning wood to heat, is causing particulate pollution.
McCormick says the severity of pollution varies by neighborhood. He says North Pole has had some of the worst conditions, with fine particulate pollution measuring in the unhealthy range.
Unhealthy is a condition where everyone may begin to experience health effects. Members of sensitive groups may experience even more serious health effects. The particulate level is running a 24-hour average in excess of 60 micrograms per cubic meter. And that's over a 24-hour average. We've had some real high numbers out there in North Pole.
People are also reminded to make sure air intakes on oil-burning heaters are ice-free to ensure they run efficiently, and to plug in vehicles to avoid cold start emissions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A recent episode of the Discovery Channel series Deadliest Catch could be used as evidence in a criminal case. The crew of the FV Northwestern is under investigation by the state, and they may have unintentionally ratted themselves out, so to speak, on camera. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
Burdell makes his first appearance during the fifth episode of Season 8. It's a slow stretch of fishing for the Northwestern, and there's not much human drama for the cameras to film until...
It's a rat!
That is in the box!
As the deckhands corral the terrified rodent into a bucket, Captain Sig Hansen lays down some folk wisdom.
The Norway rats are good luck, folks.
The crew decides to hang on to Burdell, whose name is never explained, and then the pots start rolling in full.
Captain Sig honed in on the crab once again. And his good luck charm gets a stay of execution.
We're not going to toss him over the side. I say we release him in Akadam. This is really something.
If that segment of reality TV actually does reflect reality, Hansen's decision to keep the rat could end up costing the Northwestern up to $200,000. Regulations passed in 2007 make harboring rats a Class A misdemeanor in Alaska. Releasing them into the wild is definitely illegal. State troopers are investigating the incident and wouldn't comment for this story, but if they do prosecute, it would be the first time the rat laws have been applied. Joe Meehan is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and something of a rat expert. His reaction to the video?
Yeah, I thought it was odd. I had never heard that rats could be considered as good luck.
In fact, Meehan says they're often distinctively unlucky.
Rats can chew on wires and communications equipment. They contaminate foods through their feces and urine. Just there's a whole host of problems that rats can cause for humans.
That's leaving aside their considerable environmental impacts, like destroying seabird colonies. Many of the Aleutian Islands, including Accutane, already have resident rat populations. But Meehan says new rats could strengthen their genetic pool or introduce new diseases.
Of course, not all the islands in the Aleutians have rats. And so we certainly don't want to get rats on any new islands.
People in the rat field also don't want celebrities giving other fishermen ideas. Rodent eradication is expensive. Getting rid of the vermin on Hawada, formerly known as Rat Island, cost $2.5 million. In the end, Burdell never had the opportunity to colonize any islands. A Deadliest Catch web extra suggests he was accidentally tossed off the boat.
Right overboard!
What it looked like to me is that he just abandoned ship. I think our stowaway just went for a swim.
Fish and Game's Meehan says while he's happy Burdell didn't get released on Accutane, tossing rats overboard is not the preferred method of disposal. Rats are strong swimmers, so trapping or poisoning them is the only way to ensure their demise. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new take on school lunch in Sitka.
We got to go out there and like dig through the potato bins to find the potatoes and pull up carrots and stuff.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at Condor.com.
A newcomer to the Matanuska Valley political scene is challenging House District 6 incumbent Republican Eric Feige for his seat in the legislature. Feige, a professional pilot with one House term under his belt, is a self-styled conservative voice for the district. His Democratic opponent, Jamie Duhamel, has spent the last year or so working for an anti-coal citizens group, but both candidates agree energy is the big issue. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
District 6, under the new redistricting map, stretches west to east from Sutton to Glen Allen, then south to north from Valdez to Delta Junction along the west side of the Richardson Highway. Eric Feige, a commercial air pilot, knows the territory well. He's represented most of it during his one term in the State House as District 12 representative.
You know, if you're going to try to accomplish things in the legislature, you have to at least appreciate, you can have your own opinion, certainly, but you have to appreciate that the other guy has an opinion, and you have to be able to work towards balancing your own needs, wants, and desires, your district's wants and needs and desires, and what the other guy wants.
Feige is a tall man with a serious demeanor, bespeaking his 9 years in the military. He is both a West Point graduate and teacher. As a pilot, he owned and operated a flight service in Aniak, flew commercially for Northern Air Cargo, and moved his family to Chickaloon about 12 years ago. He says the population of his big district is split, half west of Glen Allen and half along the Richardson, but all of it needs affordable energy.
We need to, as a state, come up with other ways to help provide energy to our state. Legislature's already taken a step towards building the Susitna Hydro Dam. Within my district, I got some money for the Copper Valley Electric Association last year to study the potential of putting a dam on the Tickle River. And indications are that it will be able to produce enough power year-round to certainly carry the entire Glen Allen Valdez electrical grid.
Jamie Duhamel says she was raised in an Alaska military family, born on Anchorage's Elmendorf Air Force Base. She and her family now reside in Sutton,
where we have a nice little humble piece of land, raising chickens and vegetables and just trying to teach our kids how to live off the land a bit.
She's an outspoken mother of four and has a background in social work and citizen advocacy. The race is Duhamel's first foray into state politics. She says she's well aware of the needs of Alaska's families.
For the majority of the district, it is energy. The natural gas pipeline to Valdez is a pretty critical project that we need to move forward with immediately. It will serve and benefit the majority of the district along the Richardson Highway from Fairbanks to Valdez. On the other side of the district, we're facing other types of energy development issues in the name of coal mines that are intruding upon private property rights and property values and quality of life issues.
Both candidates advocate for a natural gas pipeline, although they favor different types of projects. Feige says the Trans-Canada plan for a large diameter gas line makes most economic sense, although it won't happen until markets are found for the gas. Duhamel would prefer an all-Alaska-built gas line from the North Slope to Valdez. She says trucking natural gas to serve local customers is an option, too. Coal development has caused friction among District 6 residents within the Matanuska-Susitna borough. Feige says coal mining can be done with minimal impact.
The people of Sutton would love to see, by a margin of about 75% to 25%, would love to see the Yusubeli Coal Company come in and construct the mine that they have already had permitted for the last 20 years. But I've been to every major mine in the state. And I know that modern mining methods are very capable of extracting the resource and doing it in a way that has a minimal impact.
Conversely, Duhamel, who worked as a spokeswoman for the anti-coal group Mat-Su Coalition, says development projects should tread carefully.
we need to be really mindful of the development projects that we support. They're not all created equal. Not all jobs are created equal. And so I'm just not a proponent of mindless, job, development for development's sake. We need to make sure that the benefits will outweigh any kind of negative consequences. And when they don't, then we shouldn't proceed.
The candidates have differing views on the state administration's plan to cut oil taxes, with Feige taking the Republican line to cut taxes and Duhamel siding with the Senate's bipartisan committee block to that plan. Energy and its high cost is a common link in a district that stretches from Tidewater to the interior, and it could shape the outcome of this election. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
On the November ballot, Alaskans will vote on whether the state should hold a convention to amend or revise the Constitution. The state constitution requires that the question appear on the ballot every 10 years, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The question is simply, shall there be a constitutional convention? One of the original convention delegates plans to vote no. Vic Fisher spent the winter of 1955 and 56 hammering out the details of the state's constitution with 54 other delegates. He thinks there are some parts of the constitution that could use revising, but he says Alaskans are too divided these days to make changes that will stand the test of time. He says it was very different half a century ago.
Alaskans were unified in favor of statehood, and the constitution was written before we were becoming a state. You did not have lobbyists. You did not have special interests pushing in this direction and that direction, trying to get their specific babies into the Constitution as you would have today.
But another elder statesman of Alaska politics has a different point of view. Former Attorney General John Havelock has written a book, Let's Get It Right, arguing it's time for the state to hold another constitutional convention. He thinks the state's constitution is an excellent piece of work, but he has a long list of changes he says should be made to make the document more relevant, including protecting the permanent fund, making the legislature unicameral, and fixing the initiative process. He doesn't agree with the argument that special interests would sway the process.
There's always contention in politics, but we live in a democracy and we should let the people have a say-so on some of these essential issues that have been effectively neglected by the legislature. So I just don't think that some of these awful things that people suggest are going to happen are going to happen.
Alaska Federation of Native Convention delegates recently approved a resolution urging members to vote for a new constitutional convention to establish subsistence priority for Alaska Natives. The constitutional convention question has appeared on the ballot four times previously. It has been voted down by large margins every time, except the first time it appeared in 1970. That year, the referendum was approved by a few hundred votes. But on that ballot, the question was poorly worded. A judge ordered a new vote, and Alaskans then turned it down. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Bartlett Regional Hospital is severing its long-standing ties with Quorum Health Resources. The Tennessee-based company currently provides discounted supply purchases and management consulting to Juneau's city-owned hospital. For more than two decades, Quorum also employed Bartlett's chief executive and chief financial officers. The hospital board of directors decided last year to hire its own management team, and on Tuesday, members voted unanimously to terminate Quorum's three-year consulting contract, which took effect January 31st. Bartlett Board President Bob Storer was traveling Wednesday and unavailable to comment, but CEO Chris Harf says administrators no longer need those consulting services.
We haven't really used them since I've been here, and we kind of have
what we need to move forward and don't need additional services, and we can always go to the market and get those services if needed.
Harf says that's exactly what the hospital will do to get a new supply purchasing deal.
We already have a boilerplate RFP ready to go out. I don't expect that to take very long at all.
Terms of the contract approved by the hospital board and Juneau Assembly less than a year ago called for Bartlett to pay Quorum $380,000 a year. Officials with Quorum could not be reached for comment. The high cost of oil has driven many communities in the interior to look for fuel alternatives, including biomass. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the State Division of Forestry has put together a group of specialists to handle proposals to harvest timber for heat and power generation.
State Forestry Division Director Chris Mache says he's glad to see two biomass-fueled power plant projects have been proposed for two communities in the interior to generate less expensive heat and power with an abundant resource that really hasn't been used until now. That is timber harvested from state forests, including black spruce, that's processed and burned in high-tech, efficient, non-polluting boilers.
It's a concept that deals with working forests and using renewable resources like our forests as a way to help address high energy costs.
But it's a new kind of mission for forestry, involving long-term contracts to harvest the smaller timber from large tracts in the Tanana Valley State Forest instead of the bigger stuff that has been traditionally cut for house logs and firewood. To help forestry manage what Mache expects will be a growing demand for the resource, he's put together a group of specialists to handle the many different tasks involved in harvesting timber for biomass fuel, and to relieve the additional burden on staff at forestry area offices, like the one in Toke, that's been dealing with developing a long-term timber sales contract that's part of that community's biomass project proposal.
Essentially, we decided after taking a step back and looking at how we were trying to address the increased need for these longer-term timber sales that it was overwhelming our individual area offices, who are pretty thinly staffed.
Mache appointed Mike Curran, the agency's coastal regional forester, to head up the biomass team, a group of eight specialists that's taken the lead in the Toke project and another bigger biomass project that Fort Greely officials hope will replace that installation's diesel-fueled heat and power plant. Curran says the agency expects to be working on more such projects because of the success that school districts in Toke and Delta have had with smaller biomass systems, and because the Alaska Energy Authority has issued 22 grants to communities around the state for additional biomass project feasibility studies.
For us to be able to put out these much larger timber sales, as far as acreage goes, we would need to come up with a way to assist each area. And that's what this biomass project team concept is all about.
Mache says the large timber biomass sales project team is reworking the long-term timber sales contract proposed by Alaska Power and Telephone, the company that provides electricity for the Toke area. AP&T had proposed to harvest timber from 530 acres of state forest around Toke that would be used as fuel for a $15 million 2-megawatt power plant. AP&T proposed to build the facility to generate electricity for more than 800 homes in the community in an effort to reduce the cost of electricity that's now being produced by diesel fuel generators. Mache says forestry had to withdraw its initial support for the proposed 25-year timber sales contract because area residents wanted the agency to give local companies and native corporations a shot at competing for it. I'm Tim Ellis in Delta.
It's National Farm to School Month, and a high school in Sitka is celebrating by serving locally grown food to its students. KCAW's Ann Bryce has more.
Would you like milk?
No.
Would you like lunch?
We cook lunch. The entire class cooks lunch for the whole school.
18-year-old Aaron Quakendahl is taking a culinary class at Pacific High. It teaches students about food preparation and nutrition. In honor of National Farm to School Month, the class made a meal using local ingredients. Co-principal Sarah Ferenzi helped choose the menu.
Coho salmon with a lemon sorrel and dill pesto, served on a bed of kale, sauteed garlic.
Wait a second. Teenagers eat kale? And they like it?
Everybody thinks it's impossible to make children eat fruits and vegetables, but it's not.
All it takes, she says, is being more involved with the food we eat.
They need to have some personal investment in it, you know, and I really felt like the students who went and picked the vegetables had personal investment in those vegetables. And then
you got to go out there and like dig through the potato bins to find the potatoes and pull up carrots and stuff.
Sitka Conservation Society's Fish to Schools program provided the salmon, and students got the vegetables from down-to-earth Yupik Farm. The meal also included mashed potatoes, a barley biscuit,
and blueberry apple crisp. That was sort of as close as we could get to local for the fruit. The apples are from Washington and the blueberries were locally picked.
It might sound easy, but it's actually pretty tough to eat food grown in Sitka.
It just takes a lot of effort to grow stuff here. Stuff doesn't just spring up like it does in California or other warmer places. We have so much rain and ultimately so little sun, like this summer, it just rained all summer long. And so sometimes stuff just doesn't grow.
Erin says that although she hasn't always enjoyed cooking, the culinary class has shown her that it can be fun.
I like chopping up vegetables. Something about dicing vegetables is like therapeutic or something.
And it can also be useful.
In order to cook in the kitchen, we had to all get our food handler's card. It's a great thing to have. It's like a computer literacy class. You're just that much more desirable in the work world. My dad's like, you gotta get a job, kid. So I gotta go get a job.
17-year-old Paulette James says she can taste the difference from a typical school lunch.
I feel like we definitely have top-notch food. We're not just eating burgers that were thrown on the fryer. You can definitely like tell the difference in the food that like it's being prepared with love.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Ann Bryce in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. According to the Alaska Energy Authority and its partners, an average of $5.7 billion is spent annually on energy in Alaska. October is Energy Awareness Month, and for tips on how to save, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Come to Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th for a weekend that combines current North Pacific scientific research with a variety of fun community events and whale-watching cruises. This year, there's a convenient Juneau-Sitka ferry schedule. Information about early registration and discounts at sitkawhalefest.org. Whale Fest is science made festive and a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.